Hey, everyone. This is Scott. Listen, after we taped this week, Paul Ryan made an announcement in front of the White House after speaking with President Donald Trump that the deal to keep the government open has fallen apart. But all the stuff we talked about on this week's show is still operative, how Trump is an agent of chaos in the Republican Party and also how he's completely taken the Republican Party over, thus creating chaos within it. So we've got a great discussion for you. We're going to see what happens with this government funding situation, but enjoy the show. Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. Welcome to another episode. I'm your host, Scott Bland. This week on the show, we're going to talk about whether Donald Trump has ghosted Republican Party leadership in Congress when it came to the budget deal. He said he was psyched for a shutdown, then he kind of backed away from the fight this week, and now he seems to be a little conflicted about whether or not he might want to fight all over again. So we're going to talk about that in the context of Trump's near-total takeover of the Republican Party and what it not only means for Republican congressional leaders in situations like this, but also what it is meaning for his 2020 reelection campaign as that gets going. Plus, we are going to check in on an exotic species of Democrat, the conservative kind, ahead of some races coming in 2019. Yes, there are more elections next year before we even get to the presidential races, some really interesting gubernatorial campaigns that we are going to jump into. Stick around for the end of the show. We've got a first-of-its-kind contribution from a super fan in the credits. And a brief reminder before we get started that we are taping this a little bit before noon on Thursday, December 20th. So it's all up to date as of then. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We've got from our Politico White House team, Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We have national political reporter Alex Eisenstadt here. Hi, Alex.
Hey there.
And senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
Okay, time for our first data point, 7. As in 7 weeks, there is a plan lurching through Congress at the moment to fund the government for another 7 weeks. It is slated to run out of money and shut down at the end of this week. But there is a plan in the works to prevent that from happening, assuming President Donald Trump ends up wanting to sign it. This would push off any tough decisions about paying for the border wall the president wants so much until at least February 8th. And that's the problem. Trump wants this border wall. He's been talking about it forever since he launched his campaign. So you can see where some of the sticking points are. And I'll say here, it could all fall apart. Again, it is Thursday the 20th, a little bit before noon. As far as we know right now, it has not fallen apart yet. So we're going to skip the particulars of the budget fight here and instead step back a bit and pull on two threads about how Donald Trump fully dominates the Republican Party, for good or for bad, depending on your point of view. First, where President Trump was in this budget fight, because as I mentioned, he definitely stepped back after, as we talked about last week, stepping way out on this ledge and kind of daring Democrats to push him over, I guess. And second, I want to square that with how the president's reelection campaign is gearing up and how it's essentially subsumed the Republican National Committee, which Alex had a great story about this week. But first up, let's talk about the budget. Nancy, help us understand the thinking in the White House that has led to so many mixed messages about what the president wanted out of this budget to avert a government shutdown.
Oh, man. It really depends on who you talk to in the White House and sort of what hour of what day it is. But the White House has really been careening around this entire week, and there hasn't been a great cohesive strategy as to how they're going to approach this. And so we saw starting Sunday, you know, the White House purposely sent out Stephen Miller, a hardline immigration hawk, onto the CBS Sunday morning show. He never makes TV appearances because he's not really seen in the White House as a great communicator. But he went out there and they put him out there on purpose to kind of double down and say, like, we need that wall money and we're going to shut down the government if we don't get it. But then the White House pretty quickly started to backtrack this week. I think that they became aware that it would look bad for Trump, who is going to Mar-a-Lago tomorrow, Friday afternoon, if he was sort of at Mar-a-Lago golfing around Christmas in front of, like, you know, gold decorated Christmas trees as the government was shut down and employees potentially weren't getting paid. And then this morning, however, though, the president, because he's getting such backlash from, some House Republicans and conservative commentators like Laura Ingraham and stuff, he is really freaking out about the idea of signing this short-term budget deal that the Senate has passed.
Huh.
And so I feel like honestly, it's sort of up in the air. I talked to someone yesterday who had talked with the president who basically said this could go either way. And the president's making that clear to people. He's kind of like, we might shut down the government. Maybe I'll sign it. I don't know. This was yesterday. So I feel like where we are now is the president is worried about backlash among his base about signing this. He has like bad memories of signing a spending bill last March, which he totally ended up regretting and also caught a lot of flack from conservatives over. So we're at this place now. And so even though it's passed the Senate, I feel like it's kind of dicey right now.
That's interesting. And Charlie, this calls to mind a great detail from a story we had this week that the president was, quote, relishing the fact that Republicans are awaiting his signal and letting him set the terms. It's this reality TV mindset, right, of what's going to happen next. You know, tune in for the season finale to see whether the government stays open. But it's not so much that Republicans in Congress and the president aren't on the same page, you know, despite, you know, unified control of government, right? It's Trump isn't even on the same page with himself necessarily or the rest of his White House, because there is no page. There's who knows what the situation is at any given moment.
Right. He's always winging it. I mean, we've known that the whole time. I mean, what I was surprised at, though, is how cavalier he was, how breezy he was in talking about the idea of a shutdown, as if, whatever, we'll close it down. In fact, I'd be proud to shut it down. You know, it just reflects not only an utter disregard for the business of government or for the art of governance. And when I say utter disregard, I mean beyond anything we've ever seen. There are lots of Republican politicians who philosophically, ideologically have a problem with expansive government and the way government operates. But even by those standards, I think Trump put himself out there with his level of disregard for whether the government shuts down or not, walked into the trap by saying he'd be proud to have the government shut down. And I think it's just sort of reflective of his approach to that office, that he still hasn't really settled in and understood his role as almost the guarantor of the federal government to the American people.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that congressional leaders, like, yet again, have ceded control over this whole process to him. Like, they're just sort of trying to look for signals for him, and his signals keep changing as to what he wants sort of every hour, and that screwed them up.
Haven't congressional leaders kind of taken a little bit more control this week, though, by moving forward with this short term, basically telling him this is what we're sending you?
They have, but even this morning, like, there is chaos. I mean, I'm not on the Hill, but it seems like, from what I'm reading, it seems like there's total chaos on the Hill. Like, Trump spoke with Paul Ryan. The House Republicans canceled a scheduled press conference that they have every week. It seems like things are in flux, and Trump this morning is 100% pissed. I will say quickly that there is one face-saving measure that could save this deal. The White House has basically been looking for other ways to get that border money, and that would give them the chance to say, look, we signed this short-term spending bill, but we still have the border money. And that would allow the president to say, I fulfilled this key campaign promise to my base. Interestingly, I was told yesterday, which we haven't reported yet, so this is some fun news on Nerdcast, was that, you know, he really had instructed Mick Mulvaney, who's his incoming chief of staff and budget director, to look for that money. And that was something they were discussing on Friday. And then Trump, at the end of that meeting, offered Mulvaney officially this acting chief of staff job. And so I think that that's a key reason that Mulvaney got that job. And one thing that we've been hearing is that they're going to try to find that money from other agencies and potentially the military.
But what I don't understand, Nancy, is like, we're not talking about change that you find under a sofa cushion. I mean, if we're talking
about $5
billion.
It's like, a lot of money.
That's not a realistic proposal, is it? I mean, they're not going to be, where would they find that? That's not real.
Well, it could just be sort of money that they end up moving around. I think that that's probably why they're looking at some defense or military money, because that has a bigger budget than some other agencies. But I think that that offers sort of the best face-saving measure. And it may not even be real. Do you know what I mean? They could just say, oh, we found some money at these agencies. Maybe it's like $2 billion. But it would give the president a way to say that he was not the bad deal maker here. It would allow him to save face. And that historically has been very important for him.
Well, and this is all part of this bigger theme, right, that we've been talking about, how just the reason that these negotiations have been so difficult is because Trump has near complete control over the party at this point. Everyone's hanging on every word he says and every mood swing he has. And Alex, you dug into the political side of this this week and how this is affecting Republican, not Trump's reelection plans, but also kind of fusing with the Republican Party structure in a way that was not typical even for a sitting president in the past. Can you walk us through that?
That's right. So what you're going to have going into 2020 is a kind of an unusual setup for a reelection campaign. You're going to have the Trump campaign literally merging with the Republican National Committee. And the reason this is important is because typically the National Committee will operate sort of parallel but independent of the reelection campaign. And you've seen this time and time again. Even when you look back at George W. Bush's 2004 reelection campaign, which Karl Rove ran, and it was sort of famously seen as one of the most disciplined, effective presidential reelection campaigns ever, and it was independent of the Republican National Committee. And so the fact that Trump is doing this really shows how much he's taken over the party, how much the party and Trump are really one and the same at this point. And one other point about this is that it's striking because back in 2016, there were numerous instances of tension between the RNC and the Trump campaign, both at the staff level at the RNC. There were people at the committee who were uncomfortable with the Trump campaign. A lot of people at the committee were certain that he was going to end up losing that race. And also in terms of the 168 RNC members across the country who make up the Republican National Committee, there were many of them who were deeply uncomfortable with Trump as the nominee.
Not going to be a problem this time. And, you know, there was an interesting story yesterday about the South Carolina Republican right. Party thinking about canceling their primary, which is not an unprecedented move, but it is an unusual one. I think they said it happened in 2004 as well. So it's something that has been done when there's a sitting president on the ballot, too. But it just, again, reflects like the lack of appetite within the party to not even necessarily stand up to Trump, but create opportunities for someone to stand up to him.
Right. And you know, to go along with that, I mean, the RNC is going to be meeting next month in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There's absolutely no indication whatsoever that they're going to be creating any kind of structure for there to be debates in the Republican primary. So if you have a situation where there are no debates, where key primary states like South Carolina don't have primaries, it's going to make it really hard for some kind of alternative, whether it's a symbolic alternative or whoever, to wage any kind of primary challenge to Trump.
I mean, there's been so much attention paid to folks like John Kasich, governor right. of Ohio, or Jeff Flake, outgoing senator from Arizona, as potential protest challengers.
Right.
And I think, you know, Kasich himself said the other day that he didn't think he could win if he ran against Trump, but that seems like it's been besides the point, right?
That's right.
Some of these people feel like Trump needs to be opposed, whether or not you win. But it seems like the number of venues might be smaller than we've assumed.
The most fascinating thing about it is the thorough lockdown of the party and how quickly that happened. I mean, within the span of 2 years, a guy who was looked on as,
right.
you know, a clown who wasn't respected, who was mocked behind his back by the party, got the ultimate revenge. He does something no other president would have even tried. I mean, the efficiency and streamlined nature of this new Trump reelect Death Star is something that other presidents would have wanted had they had the gumption
yeah.
or the clout within the party to do that, but they didn't. And so not only does he have the clout within the party to have that unified structure, we're now talking about South Carolina getting rid of their primary, as you mentioned. Not that that's new. They've done that before. But also New Hampshire, where there was a debate among Republicans recently about whether the state party should stay neutral or endorse the president. And so this is happening in state after state after state. He's just locking it down after, you know, he came into office. Remember, Alex, you did all that reporting on the takeover of the Ohio state party, the takeover of the Michigan party, and installing Trump people at the top of that. And it's just amazing that it's happened so quickly.
Well, it's also amazing because it's like, you know, you look at something like this week where there's like no real strategy or it's just, you know, everyone being whipsawed by the president day after day on the shutdown thing. And I think that people have this sense that the whole Trump orbit is completely unorganized. But as you said, like the way that they have they're already orienting themselves towards 2020 and sort of how efficient that has been, I think shows that, you know, if you take away all the palace intrigue and the noise on a day-to-day basis, like they are very organized about some things.
Alex, I want to pose a question to you about this. How much of this is happening because Trump has locked down the party base to such a great extent? You know, I'm talking about rank and file voters here, that the party apparatus sees this and says, okay, like we need to do this fusion. Like Trump is the party at this point, and how much of it is moving the other direction, that because the party elite has rallied so closely to Trump, with a few notable exceptions that we just mentioned, that has kind of flowed, that signaling has flowed down to the party base.
No, it's a good question. I think they're both true. I think the party elites here in Washington are in part responding to what the Republican electorate wants and what is certainly expected of them, the fact that Trump is likely to be the Republican nominee in 2020. One thing to note, the people who are sort of many of the people who are running this Trump 2020 operation, some of these are mainstream Republican operatives who've been in the business for a long time. And so one of them, you look at a really critical player in Trump 2020, is a guy by the name of Chris Carr, who's been involved, sort of a behind the scenes player in Republican politics for some time. Well, Carr is going to be really important because over the next several months, he's going to be doing interviews with top Republican field staffers in a number of key states, and he's going to be interviewing and hiring people. So you're going to have potentially Trump hires on the ground in the first quarter of 2019, before even Democrats have even announced their campaigns. And so that just sort of tells you, it kind of shows you how mainstream Republican operatives are merging along with the Trump campaign and are really getting going for 2020, even at a time, by the way, when Trump is under increasing political and legal duress, right? This is a guy who the water is kind of rising on the legal front. I mean, we see a number of issues that he's having to face legally, but nevertheless, his political operation is sort of moving forward here.
And I just wonder, like, will that end up biting them in the ass? Because, you know, we don't know what the Mueller report's going to say. Like, we don't know what that legal landscape will look like in 2019. And meanwhile, they're moving ahead.
And this Charlie, last word.
Yeah, this speaks to Nancy's point earlier about the real order in that operation is on the political side. Because if you take a look at the politics people, the people handling the politics that Alex just mentioned, that's where all the skill is. You don't find the miscreants and the grifters and the exiles that you see on the governance side.
Right.
You know, it's all the most competent mainstreamers are all on the political arm.
Right.
That's a great point. And maybe something to keep in mind as we watch whether or not this budget deal actually happens at the end of this week. All right, thank you, Nancy and Alex, for coming in to help us figure it out.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Charlie, I know you're sticking around for segment two, for which we are also going to welcome in politics reporter Daniel Strauss. Daniel, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Daniel is here to talk about our next data point, which is three. There are three governor's races in 2019. Before we get to the presidential race, before any of the primaries start, we've got to get through three governor's races. And the Democrats who are going to be running in these governor's races are really interesting and unusual. These are tough races in the South. We've got Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And looking at these candidates, it's just noteworthy how different they are from the national party at large, or the candidates who Democrats are putting up are in 2019 to run for president in 2020. Daniel, who are these people?
These are all what you would expect in traditional Southern races. These are household name Democrats who like to eschew the party name. I think the most famous of these Democrats is Governor John Bel Edwards in Louisiana, who had an upset win a few years ago there and has remained
over David Vitter,
and has remained pretty popular among Democratic governors in the country. Despite being in a deep red state, despite governing as Trump took office in the White House. And then in both Mississippi, which is always a tough state for Democrats, and Kentucky, there are household names. Jim Hood, who I think might be the only attorney general with a mullet in the country.
We need more attorney generals with mullets. We were just having this conversation.
I mean, and he sounds like I had one operative describe him as trying to be a hill country Democrat. And that was shorthand in Mississippi for someone who can relate to Republicans and rural voters in genuine ways.
At the end of the day, after time with my family, I like to go out to my shop and just fix things. With me, what you see is what you get.
Hood has been a mainstay of Democratic politics in Mississippi.
I mean, you could argue he is Democratic politics in Mississippi. He's been the only statewide elected for a long time, and he's been elected four times statewide.
He's survived while the Democratic Party has really atrophied in the state.
And now he's looking for the promotion. And
He's but for a long time he's been thought as someone who could run for governor someday.
And who's the third Democrat that we're talking about in Kentucky?
The third is Andy Beshear.
Also an attorney general.
Also an attorney general whose father was a popular governor of Kentucky. And he, too, is trying to distance himself from the national party and the national discourse about being liberal firebrands and proud Democrats who want to abolish ICE. None of these guys who are running are eager to embrace mantles like that.
Right, right. Charlie, I think the striking thing about these candidates is not just to me. It's not just how different they are from the rest of the national party, but about how they might be the only people left of kind of a former state party brand in all three of these places where Democrats used to run the show and have completely gotten wiped off the map in the last 10, 20 years.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, those are states where the pivot to the Republican Party was so fast and so overwhelming in those places. It's, you know, they're very hostile to the national Democratic Party. All of those states, you know, it's harder and harder if you're a younger politician and you're looking at your future prospects. You know, and this is how politicians think sometimes, especially if you're sort of a centrist. You're never going to ply your wares in the Democratic Party just because the national brand is so tarnished. So these guys are, you know, they're like an exotic species. They're you know, rare orchids, albino alligators, white tigers. You know, I mean, you just don't see it a lot, and they have to be better at what they do. I mean, they're extremely skilled. Generally, you have to be pretty good at retail. You know, you have to have a whole bunch of different skill sets, and you have to be able to get distance from your national party. You know, when it gets tough for them is, you know, they usually – this is a different brand of Southern Republican or border state Republican than, say, right around the turn of the century. Because remember in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a kind of little burst of Democratic governors in the South, in Georgia, in Oklahoma, you know, so border states in the South, but they were different. These folks are in a different era when it's even harder than it was before.
Yeah, Daniel, and you introduced them a little bit, but give us some examples here of how these folks are different and have separated themselves from the national party ideologically. John Bel Edwards obviously has been a governor and has had an opportunity to do that from the governor's office.
Right. And paradoxically, for someone who is sort of a prize for the party in holding the Louisiana governor's mansion, he is not the most liberal on, say, guns or abortion.
He signed one of the most strict anti-abortion laws in the country. Right.
Right. And to be honest, Scott, I've been a little surprised with how little backlash he's gotten from the national party over this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, in Jim Hood, you've got kind of guy with a law and order reputation who's been around for a while. Beshear is interesting because he doesn't have as long a record as some of the others.
Right.
He kind of has his father's record to lean on.
Right. And Beshear is in an unusual and arguably the most advantageous situation of the three, because Matt Bevin is not very popular.
And that's the Republican governor of Kentucky.
Yes, that's the Republican governor of Kentucky, who, you'll recall, was a primary challenger to Mitch McConnell. And as far as I can tell, McConnell is not super interested in getting into this governor's race, especially as he gears up for re-election. But but it's conceivable that he would not do everything in his power to protect the incumbent government.
That's a really good point. You've got in addition to these three being heavily Republican states at the national level, you do have three different situations here. You've got an incumbent Republican who's very unpopular in Kentucky. You've got an incumbent Democrat who's relatively popular in Louisiana, and then an open race in Mississippi.
Right. And then the thing about Mississippi, though, is that he hasn't announced yet, but Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves has long been thought to be a prime candidate to run for governor.
For the Republicans.
Yeah, for the Republicans. So this is – so if he runs, which he's extremely likely to do, Hood versus Reeves in the general election is a scenario that a lot of operatives and voters and activists on both sides have been preparing for a while.
Clash of the Titans, yeah, so to speak. Charlie, the other thing that I think about with these races is just how I'm curious to what lengths some of these candidates are going to have to go to wall themselves off from what's going on in the presidential race, where you're going to have all these national Democratic politicians competing in a primary, trying to get ideologically to the left of each other, sucking up national media attention, while these three in these three states, you've got a Democratic governor candidate kind of trying to fight against the tide and survive despite those national changes in the party.
Yeah, it's going to be even tougher than it normally would with that backdrop, the presidential backdrop. You know, the tide's going to be coming in and it's going to be filled with sharks and, you know, barracuda and all
kinds
of things.
You are full of metaphors today, Charlie. You fueled up the metaphor tank before you stepped in the studio.
I think I was just watching too many Animal Planet videos recently. I love those things. No, but it's going to be really tough for them because they are going to own every statement that comes out of that Democratic primary. But their opponents or the press or someone is going to ask them, well, are you for Medicare for all? What about this? How about abolishing ICE? How about this? And each time they're going to have to explain themselves and they're going to have to figure out a way to get distance from that national party and sort of mainstream themselves in these very conservative states. And that is not going to be an easy task at all.
And Daniel, talking to Hood and Bashir for the story you wrote, you kind of got a preview of how that's going to happen a little bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, they are not they are very much interested in not nationalizing their race. They are eager to separate themselves from the national party. And they didn't sound very interested in campaigning with any Democrat or Democratic candidate in the presidential arena. I got to say, though, that it's not – I mean, these are not early primary states, but these are definitely states that in a big presidential primary, a Democrat might want to travel to
pretty
early
be showing
on.
Up.
Yeah.
But here's the other problem, though, with speaking about the presidential. We haven't even mentioned Trump yet. Like, these are places where Donald Trump is very popular.
Right.
You know, whether you're talking about Kentucky or Mississippi or Louisiana, it's not like he's – you know, people are sort of mixed or there's, you know, an enormous suburban population that hates him. I mean, these are places where the president is over 50% in approval and places where he will win those states easily in 2020.
And he'd be eager to host a rally there for any of these candidates. I mean, he's because he remains popular and he loves large rallies, it's hard to imagine him not jumping for joy at the prospect of helping, say, Matt Bevin.
Yeah, that could be a saving grace for Bevin, right?
Right.
Who's very unpopular. You said he's had all sorts of fights with you know, teacher strikes and
most recently
the party,
the press,
all sorts of it's been a little bit messy for Matt Bevin.
It's been getting weird.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's, I mean, hey, we're all political junkies. We're going to have a fun time watching this in 2019, especially, and it'll, you know, give us a little something to dip into now and then as the presidential race is heating up as well. Daniel, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Charlie, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. That was an excellent conversation. And thank you as well to our listeners for tuning in this week. All right, as promised, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan, Terrell Mazel, our esteemed colleague and friend at Politico and a true Nerdcast OG, is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Our producer is Micaela Rodriguez with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Terrell. Listeners, if you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you again for listening. We'll talk to you next week.